Well, hi, everybody. This is Dave. Welcome. Thank you again for all of the communications, all the things you've sent in, the answers to the questions, and the kind words. I appreciate it. That really does help me shape and direct some of the discussion, so I appreciate that. So as we begin, any questions, clarifications, or comments as we begin Seminar 3, or before we actually officially start? I'm interested in thoughts or questions or clarification from any of you, or even how you're finding the material in terms of practical application for your own purposes of marketing your coaching practice. Comments, questions, input. Are you finding the ways of thinking about incorporating the mind and brain and even performance sciences that we've been sort of alluding to without really spelling out any theory? Are you finding that useful to begin to shape your thinking about how you connect and communicate with clients rather than just give information or sticking with the facts or hoping that when you tell somebody the great stuff you do, that that's going to be a sufficient reason for them to proceed with you? Any thoughts or reflections on that aspect?
Yeah, hi, Dave. It's Eric. How are you?
Hey, Eric. How you doing?
I'm good. It's good to hear your voice.
The same,
I just want to tell you, I am in the process of threading a lot of this into my actual seminars and coaching practices. I think it's extremely powerful. And the reason I say that is because I think it gives you a very different way of connecting with clients and getting clients to really think about what it is that they're trying to do themselves. I think it's that powerful.
Well, I can, thank you. Go ahead.
That's what I think.
Well, I can tell you how this is under the subtitle of I learn well but not quickly. I usually do maybe three or four teleseminars or presentations before I convert something to a more permanent product, like a webinar or something like that. And I had done two or three of these for CTA and two or three under MentorPath, and I realized after doing a few that I hadn't really listened to myself. I hadn't really incorporated the things that I had learned through this immersion over a couple of years in doing the research for this. I hadn't applied it to my own marketing, as if I were immune somehow from this process. And when I recognized that and revised my marketing offering, this was for MentorPath under my own umbrella, the first time I revised it according to these principles, I got 8 times the subscribership of my next highest number for myself or CTA. So I can tell you it works. And again, if you learn well and quickly, it can also be very helpful. But these are things that I did initially because it's something I was really interested in another area of coaching, to apply the mind and brain and performance sciences, and it seemed like it could be a useful contribution, and it's something I also wanted to get information about. And I realized after I did it for everybody else that, oh, yeah, I need to do this too. So I think that you'll find it hopefully interesting and especially applicable and effective in what you do, because when we look at how people really make decisions instead of how we think they make decisions, or even especially how they think they make decisions, and this is what launched the whole field of behavioral economics, of how people really make decisions rather than how they think they decide. So there's a great deal that goes into the science and the research behind this, and I'm hoping to distill it in a practical and applicable way for you. So thanks for mentioning that, Eric, and I appreciate it.
You got it.
Okay. Other thoughts, questions, comments?
Hi, David. This is Marian. So what I want
Welcome.
To
How are you?
Very good. How are you?
Super.
So I feel like it's comforting to know that it's like being versus doing. So the more you are the kind of a person, it feels like it's much easier to market yourself because you're like it's so deep into psychology. So that comforts me. And then also because like I'm training to become a coach, I'm in my fourth week of the program.
Ah, yeah.
So I'm not a coach yet. And then in the back of my mind, I'm like, with all this learning and concept and theory, am I going to be able to apply in like in actuality when I do become a coach? And I know I will because like I truly feel like I am the kind of a person, but also at the same time, like from theory to practice, I'm going to need to be able to bridge that, and there might be a challenge.
First of all, I want to Dutch Uncle correct you. You are a coach. You're a coach with 4 weeks of experience, but nobody needs to know that. You're a coach. You have a coaching practice. And as you present yourself in that way, then I think it will be even more apparent to your potential clients with your confidence and clarity and specificity of how you simply talk about what you will do for them that they're going to be interested. Think about how when you go to any other professional, let's say you go to a doctor, and the doctor, hopefully with confidence and competence, will ask you some questions and then make a recommendation. The doc doesn't waffle. The doc doesn't say, well, what do you think about us working together? And in some studies, confidence, and we're going to talk about this as we talk about mindset mastery development in this seminar, confidence trumps competence. Now, hopefully you'll have both, but this is to address what may be lagging, the confidence that goes with the competence and the development of skills that you've done. So that's what's really important here, because how you present yourself, once you know that when someone is working with you, they're going to be probably better than they've ever been before in their life or their business. So you'll know and have the confidence. This is just simply to conceptualize it in a way so that you can communicate that both in your experience and in your words, and know that it's not about selling. It's not about providing information or convincing someone. It's about a collaborative mode that together you can co-create a new experience for the client. And the client is point of reference. It's all about the client. It's not about you. And lose any thoughts about do you have credentials or experience or all of that. It's about the client and what benefit you can bring the client at this time. That's what matters, and that's what we're looking at, to look at how does someone go about decide how can you optimally develop your performance as a coach, and performance is not the right word, but your collaborative engagement as a coach so that you can optimize the client's experience. And that's what this is about, because once we know more about how the mind and brain work and know some things about performance science, we can make them all congruent and all go in the same direction to really create an efficiency. And back to what you said initially, it has to be authentic. This is not about marketing or selling or anything. This has to be authentic. Your concern, your care in the crucible of authenticity can be developed with some of these experiences, some of these ways of thinking, but it has to be authentic. It has to be genuine because, you know, just like, you know, a child's eye can spot a forgery a mile away, so can a client. It has to be authentic. It has to be genuine and about the client. So that's what all of this is to enhance. So thank you for mentioning that And it's a process, and especially for those of you who are beginning, it's a process. And confidence, as we'll discuss momentarily, is a state of mind. And I have a quiz from Carnegie Mellon to begin this this seminar that will be of interest to you. And you already know the answer from that preface, so thanks for mentioning that. Really address your thought and question?
Above and beyond. Thank you so much.
Okay, super. Anything else? Anything else anybody would like to discuss or bring up or just highlight at this point? Okay, well, jot down anything. I'll reserve some time at the end for a discussion. And I think I mentioned last time, just so we have a chance to have a fuller discussion and that we cover everything that you think about as you reflect on this material and your experience here, I want to add maybe 10 or 15 minutes at the end of Seminar 4 next week so that if you can, we'll go over 10 or 15 minutes to be able to have a discussion at the end to cover anything that may still be unanswered or that may be helpful for you in applying this. So add that on if you can at all with your schedules. So I'll put us on lecture mode, and we'll come back and have a discussion at the end here. Okay, as I mentioned, we're going to talk about mindset mastery development, and here's the quiz to launch this topic. Carnegie Mellon University did a large study to determine the major factor for professionals earning the trust of others. Of these four things, this is not a trick question. Which was most important? Established, proven expert, confidence of the professional, demonstrated actual current expertise, and reputation. As before, we're going to come back and answer that. First, to define mindset. Mindset is simply a set of assumptions and beliefs that determine how we perceive, process, and behave. It's analogous to a software program on your computer. Each state of mind is its own software program, and our mindsets consciously and unconsciously determine our choices. Think about how with a computer program, you input information. You can only input certain information for a specific program. Then once input, there's an entire set of algorithms that determine how it's processed, all the options, and then the outcome. Same with mindset. Elite athletes know how to get themselves in an optimum state before going on the court and field and how to sustain it. Masterful performers in other areas other than athletics, like actors, speakers, storytellers, do this as well. Getting in state is both mental and emotional and physical. A significant persuasion and leadership competency is self-regulation and self-management. That is, knowing your own skills and deploying them effectively in a mindset that's specifically matched to the task. In other words, if you want to edit what you're writing, a creative mindset is not the one to get in. There's not a fit there, and vice versa. So mindset strategies of successful persuasion is what I want us to focus on first. How do you get a potential prospect you may not even know or don't even see in a state of mind to consider your service or product? And this is one of the recurring questions that I got about how you can develop this information in a way to enhance your practice and get more clients. So first, let's look at how successful people and top sellers do this? What are the keys? What are the common elements about a mindset strategy of successful persuasion? Successful people do these things. They regulate their emotional state. They manage the prospect's state, and remember to use that term interchangeably with client. We'll come back to that. The prospect and the market approach needs to be effective and enjoyable. In other words, if you're not having fun, don't expect the client to have fun. Build trust, create and sustain interest and commitment, especially understand their needs and show them how to meet them. And lastly, remain flexible. The person most flexible masters the situation. I'm going to give you some examples in a bit. Whatever meaning you associate to a stimulus determines behavior. So to persuade, know and communicate the emotional reasons to buy now. Then the logical reasons to buy now. But remember, we know from neuroeconomics that people make purchase decisions first, then kick it up to the part of the brain that is conscious and intellectual and logical. But the decision to buy or not buy happens up to 10 seconds before the person is even aware of it. So the next time you want somebody to get on board with your idea or service, what do? Simply tell a story where you spell out the outcome. We now know from the mind and brain sciences that storytelling is the most powerful way to implant ideas into someone's mind. This is the brain science of story. When we're being told an effective story, it activates not only the language processing areas, but also areas used to experience each of the events of the story. Someone tells us how delicious a peach is, our sensory cortex lights up. When it's about emotion, our right neocortex gets active. When the story characters grab an object, those motor neurons activate. When characters observe a scene, vision-related neurons fire. A story puts the whole brain to work. And why do you think entertainers are paid so much more than educators? Because they create state changes. Stories affect us mentally as well as physically. Ann Crindall at the Dartmouth Brain Lab showed how viewers' brains resonated with the specific emotion enacted on the screen. When the central character was angry, the viewers' brains registered anger as well. When the scene was sad, viewers' brains corresponded. Whenever we feel disgust, that brain region, the anterior insula, fires. We sense the other person's intentions and imagine what an experience means in his or her mind. Mindsight, our innate ability to see into each other's minds, relies on attunement of empathic resonance with someone else's subjective experience. The teller's state of mind and intention is the key to the listener's reception. For example, if we sense that the other person is phony or distracted, we automatically distance or tune out. When someone genuinely smiles, looks directly into our eyes, engages us, it enhances the inclination to relax and feel more trusting. And you buy this big blue puffy coat sometimes. This means that getting in state needs to be before you face your reader or listener. Those of you who have done acting know how you have to get in character three steps before you enter the set or the stage. Before, that way, you're not doing it in front of people. You're already there. Because the first impression, that emotional connection is there as soon as you're viewed, as soon as there's an engagement. Relax your body. control your breath, get solidly grounded to access the optimum state of mind for a particular task. We're going to return to that because that matching is really important. The primary reason to get in state is to concentrate your energy on a full, undisturbed immersion in your engagement, first with yourself, then with the other. People like, respect, trust, and are influenced by those who have the ability to remain calm and thoughtful. This default setting to remain centered and grounded no matter what becomes an essential success paradigm. Like any state of mind, it's contagious, amygdala to amygdala, person to person. Regulating your own state of mind in a sustained way is the most effective influence on someone else to do the same. So let's look now at the mindset tools of persuasion. The law of authenticity is this: the most valuable gift you have to offer is yourself, to be authentic, genuine. One, rapport. For a long-term impact, establish authentic, caring, and emotional investment. Highlight mutual interest. Remember the quiz from Seminar 1. Tell a story that solves a challenge, something that really resonates with something that the person in listening is going to get. Ask what you can do for them. Perhaps give an authentic compliment if that's natural. 2, ask questions. Direct the focus from problems to possibilities. That's our initial reframing as coaches. When you look at possibilities, it activates new neuronal pathways and networks. When you look at problems, you go down an already existing pathway. So ask about a problem. Boots up a problem mindset. That has no future since the problem has already occurred and someone's all too willing to get all activated and charged by telling the problem. Think about, you know, you have an understandable, natural discussion over a glass of wine with somebody. You talk in paragraphs, and somebody is going to sooner or later, usually sooner, start talking about problems and get all animated with problems. Focus changes state. So move to a mindset of openness and exploration. Reframe, as you do in coaching. Somebody talks about a problem. What's the possibility here? What might be a possibility that you could be able to do? What else do you think of? You're nudging a client to an openness and a direction in the choice architecture of possibility of challenge rather than a problem-enclosed system. You're converting a period to a comma. Focus changes state. Think about the kind of a paradigm. There's a infant or a toddler who's just crying, inconsolable. Nobody can do nothing. And then suddenly you jangle some car keys and boom, the focus is on the car keys. And there's an instantaneous state change. Focus changes state, which is why powerful questions that are clear, brief, and simple become powerful because it helps the client and thereby you together to focus on that. As you look at helping the client develop possibility and a positive outcome, when people imagine, it becomes real for them. So, 1, rapport. 2, ask questions. 3, personal congruity. What you say verbally and non-verbally match. A tool of influence comes from being confident about what you're saying. The person who feels the most certain, the most confident, is the greatest influencer. And 4, state management. The mindset tool of persuasion that is really powerful. State management of yourself and to manage emotions and state of mind of the client. Maybe even helping the client to get grounded and centered, to self-regulate, to take a moment to take a couple of deep breaths and get grounded and centered. Then intend to proceed. So here's the difference, in one way of looking at it, between success and failure. The two most important determinants of success, beliefs and state management. Let's look at those. A belief is the blueprint, the software of the unconscious mind. Focus aligns the energy field of the brain, and repeated focus rewires the brain. In this way, belief becomes an anatomical reality. The beliefs that your clients already have are also anatomical realities, so this may be in the foreground at times of challenge of looking at reframing and refocusing there. Beliefs determine what we will or what we don't do or won't do, what we believe. In other words, the meaning that we feel certain will come from situations can determine how we behave and what we'll do. Social neuroscientists show us that we have to believe in what we're seeing or we won't even see it. And it won't sell. Underline that for this seminar series. So, how can you create a new belief? The oak sleeps in the acorn. Success comes to those who become success conscious. Failure comes to those who indifferently allow themselves to become failure conscious, who play not to lose instead of playing to win. The only known method of voluntary conscious development of belief is the repetition of affirmations to your unconscious. You get what you focus on. We come to believe what we repeat to ourselves, whether it's true or false. In other words, if a lie is repeated, it ultimately is experienced as the truth, even on a lie detector test. The teller ultimately can't tell the difference because the brain has been rewired for it to be a fact. This neuroscience principle emphasizes the need and power of positive focus. Visions, visualization, are the seedlings of reality. If you can't see significant wealth in your imagination and your vision, you won't see it in your bank account. Systematic, repeated visualization rewires the brain. Affirmations are stories that support the visualizations to revise mind software. Now, unlike The Secret or The Law of Attraction, you can't just see, believe, and experience it. You have to work at it. You have to systematically have a plan to create it. So it's the ABCs to end it with a creation, to have a systematic way. This is what we do in coaching, to look at the creation of it. You're not ready for something until you believe you can acquire it. I want to say this again. Systematic, repeated visualization rewires the brain. Affirmations are the stories that support the visualizations, and they revise mind software. So belief can be inscribed by affirmation or repeated instructions to the unconscious mind. Repetition of affirmations to your unconscious mind is a powerful method of voluntary development of belief. Any thought that's repeatedly passed on to the unconscious mind becomes finally accepted. This is as true for wealth accumulation as it is for other consistent repetitions, such as crime. So basically, there are a couple of types of belief. Global beliefs, like, well, people are, or I am, or life is, you know, fill in the blank. Each affects the way we look at and interpret things and their meanings. Another are the rules, the contingencies that we have, the cause and effect beliefs. If this, then that, or if then. We have brain algorithms of behavior, emotional, and attachment patterns that couples cues and responses. Now, people will say yes much more readily to your belief than to your information or even your technical sales skills. They come to believe what you believe. So the first sell is to yourself. Selling is the transference of emotion. You must feel certain to make someone believe. The primary way you convince someone is if you're convinced. You'll transfer automatically without trying, and don't get in the way of this by trying to. You'll transfer whatever state of mind you're in, from doubt to confidence. 2, state management. Here's an everyday application to recognize and understand emotional couplings. Regardless of how logical we think we are, our first register of a new stimulus is emotional. Any new input goes directly to the amygdala to sort out, and then the hippocampus attaches meaning. This is where the unconscious is. For those psychoanalytic fans, the unconscious actually resides in the hippocampus because that's where meaning and attribution is attached. Then it goes to the forebrain to process consciously and intellectually to make logical sense. So hear the progression. That's why it takes 10 seconds to do all this internal navigation for a purchase decision to go up finally to the prefrontal cortex to make it logical and conscious and sensible. Now, our state of mind, the software package, determines the meaning we attach to a stimulus, and the meaning attached determines the behavior. Each state of mind contains its own beliefs, associations, and set of experiences. Think about it this way. You're at home, relaxing after dinner with your partner, having a glass of wine, and a great conversation. There's a noise in the backyard. You likely don't hear it, or if you do, you dismiss it. The next evening, Wednesday, you're home alone. You've just watched the last installment of Clarice, and you hear the same noise. You're alert to it, vigilant. You check it out. Same stimulus, but the state of mind that Clarice induced determines the meaning attached. Everything at the lower emotional brain and the midbrain are unconscious processes. The emotional activation registers before cognitive areas of the brain come into play to assess options. This is where neuroeconomics and behavioral economics research demonstrates that we make decisions, actually buy decisions, purchase decisions first, even though we think we're doing it for the reasons that we logically and consciously, but after the fact, attach to it. It's an effect rather than a cause. So once we unconsciously make an emotional commitment to a yes or a no, these lower brain structures send the conscious mind on a mission to gather all the logical reasons to support that decision. Then we cherry-pick data to support that pre-selected belief. We find something logical and sensible for it to light on, even if it's not accurate as a cause and effect. This rationalization becomes a confirmation bias. We seek data to confirm the belief that we have. The failure to notice contradictory data, in other words, an inattention blindness, that's the other factor that goes with confirmation bias, is the inattention blindness. If we don't believe it, we're likely not to see it. So when we make a choice, we couple memory from past experiences with the best guesses of a likely future. Our lives are determined by our choices. These choices are informed by what we focused on and shaped by the meaning that we then attribute. The part of the brain that anticipates pleasant outcomes, the nucleus accumbens, activates a buy decision. That's also the part of the brain that gives us a hit of dopamine, the pleasure chemical. A don't-buy decision originates in the insula, an area that's involved in anticipating pain. These anticipatory emotions bias as well as drive decision-making. Let's look at how that's applied. Credit cards decouple buying, the activation of the pleasure center, and paying, activation of the pain center of the brain. The pleasure of the purchase is segmented from the pain of future payment. This segmentation renders repayment a future abstraction. Our optimism bias seems, I'm going to have more money next month. At the very least, my dear self, tomorrow's another day. So, what happens then? Here's the data. When we buy with a credit card, we purchase 23% more than when we pay with cash or check, because it only activates the pleasure center of the brain, and it doesn't mess with the center that has to do with anticipating pain. That's also why it's hard to save, because of the way our minds and our brains are wired. It's hard to resist the immediate pleasure of buying. There's that dopamine hit. Making and spending money both activate the pleasure center of the brain, mediated by dopamine. It's tougher. It's difficult to substitute a theory like long-term saving, retirement, a future need for this immediate payoff. It's like, well, this is a good idea for year after next, but here's that cheesecake with strawberry topping right now. So, three reasons people fail. Let's get back to your practice and your products. Three reasons people fail. Not enough compelling reasons to purchase. Limiting belief systems. And or inability to consistently manage state of mind. All of these things you will be doing as a professional who makes a professional recommendation for the benefit of the client. Let's talk about how. First, regulation of states of mind. Your state of mind, the particular software program you use, determines the meaning you attach to a stimulus. Now, this is repetition. The meaning you attach then determines behavior. Now, there are two primary ways, two powerful ways, to regulate your state of mind. One is physiology, the other is focus. Physiology can be simply how you use your body, your biochemistry, to change your state of mind. This can be simply by relaxation, by focus on deep breathing, or even by something more structured like meditation. And then, in addition to physiology, a focus, what and how you direct conscious attention. From quantum physics and brain science, you get what you focus on, not what you want. Focus aligns your energy field of your brain. What you focus on, what you pay attention to, determines your state of mind. Our minds work by consciously selecting the one focus that we want to register at any moment. This is the beauty of a focus, like of a map. When you have a focus, when you have a map, all the stuff that you don't have to pay attention to is not even relevant. You're focusing on one thing. When you have a map, all the stuff that you don't pay attention to, you don't even have to engage. By holding this one thing in conscious awareness, we give relative inattention to everything else. This means that we have an immediacy bias. We assign undue weight to whatever we pay more attention to at the moment. So, you have in your outline a mindfulness focus method that actually I included because think about what an application this is for focus. When you do a mindfulness meditation, even if it's a 2-minute mindfulness meditation, you focus in a very relaxed state only on one thing, of breathing in and breathing out. And as brains have the job description to do, you'll begin to think of something. You'll have a thought, you release it, you let it go. If you're visual, you let it float away. Or just in some way you don't engage it and refocus on your breath. That's exactly the model that a focus provides. That's exactly the model that you do with your client. As you begin to engage with your client, you're focusing on what the client says. There may be something distracting. There may be something the client says or does. It reminds you of your sister and how you've had a you refocus on the client, on the client's story, and engaging fully in that to co-create that. So you anchor your experience in this moment and in this experience of focus and physiology. Now, here's the power of coaching as well. The questions we ask determine what we focus on. Questions direct the focus and therefore determine the state that we're in. And that's why as you become accustomed more and more to engaging and directing a coaching conversation as opposed to a usual conversation that you have in life with a friend where it's like a free association and you take turns, you're having a coaching conversation that's already framed by what the client wants to focus on, where the client wants to go, and you're helping to shape and direct that conversation for the client to successfully approximate where they want to go, and if they detour or distract, you get them to refocus. If they revert back into the default mode of talking about problems, you reframe to looking at the possibility of this moment. So again, questions determine what we focus on. Questions direct the focus and thereby determine the state that we're in. Here's an example of how you get what you focus on, not what you want. The great aerialist Carl Wallenda, patriarch of the flying Wallendas, had performed death-defying feats on the high wire for more than 50 years. Still, at the age of 71, Wallenda's capacity for focus on his intention was legendary. His concentration on success became a self-fulfilling prophecy for over five decades of triumph on the high wire. What you focus on grows. Wallenda's wife indicated that he had been anxious the day before taking the wire, a tightrope in San Juan, Puerto Rico. For the first time in all the years that she'd known him, he focused on the risk of falling. He personally supervised the attachment of the guy wires, which he had never done before. During the performance, he tragically fell to his death. You get what you focus on. For coaching, asking effective questions determines the state of mind. This is your power of focus. Ask habitual questions of yourself that empower you. And remember, the most effective questions as well as the most effective sentences are clear, brief, and specific. The best mentors, leaders, and teachers are the ones who ask the best questions to get us to use our own resources. So let's look at an optimum performance state of mind. The difference between a professional and an amateur, between massive success or less, is the ability primarily to manage your state of mind, to achieve and sustain a peak performance state. So here's a mindset formula for optimizing persuasion. And remember, this is what we're talking about. Find the challenge or the problem, the deep want or interest in your client that is unfulfilled. What they can't do or be themselves, that's what they're going to be willing to pay you for. Show this person how to solve the problem or meet the challenge. Associate positive consequences if they do. Associate negative consequences if they don't. Now, I'm not saying go through and spell this out or try to convince someone or have a sentence for each of these, but this is what you want to have in your mind to look at possibility. And it may be simply, you know, what we discussed in this brief session is a sample of a larger issue that I believe an engagement in professional coaching could make a major difference for the rest of your life or make a significant turnaround for your business. Here's what I would recommend. And we're going to talk about that component because that's a story in its own right in a bit. So here's a mindset formula. Show prospects how to solve the problem or meet the challenge, as I've said. Associate positive consequences if they do, negative consequences if they don't. So how do you apply that? The mindset formula of persuasion associates, not telling, but associates buying with getting pleasure, not buying with pain. Remember, people will do more to avoid pain than to seek pleasure. Risk aversion. This is why we focus on results and consequences to become more effective. And the little thing that I mentioned, it's the focus on the positive consequences. And you have to truly believe, but I believe it when I say it, I think this will make a major difference for the rest of your life, or that you can get to a place in your business or in your life that you have not even quite imagined yet. And we know that someone can only envision from their own system. So that's a pretty good bet. The primary reason we do what we do is how we imagine we're going to feel when we do it. So this persuasion process is centered on getting the person to clearly associate the most desired feeling or state with your product or service. Now, there are three primary reasons someone fails to persuade. No compelling purpose during a challenging time. Limiting beliefs like it won't work, or I've tried before, or, I've tried everything, and nothing works. And not consistently managing mindset. The ability to change a state of mind is often the difference between success and failure. Now, of the insights that neuroscience brings to the business world, one of the most powerful is the ability to understand how a consumer connects various concepts about your brand at an unconscious level. It's crucially important to have a clear and exact understanding of the individual elements that make up the existing unconscious perceptions of a product or service. We're gonna spend all of seminar 4 on neuromarketing to look in more depth at various aspects of that. But let's apply that in a simple first step way to your business. Selling is transferring emotion. Your state of mind will have emotional contagion. That's way more powerful than information or facts. Manage your state because it induces a state in others. You associate positive or negative emotion or state to your services or product. So will your prospect. If you're not in a peak state, such as maybe feeling down or a lesser expectation or a depletion, that will also be emotionally contagious. And it has to be authentic. Authentic energy is contagious. When your story truly excites you and you let that excitement show, it will be infectious to prospect. You really have to believe that if somebody works with you, they're going to get to a place that's better than they've ever been in their life or their business before. Your authenticity of genuine enthusiasm and conviction will resonate with prospects. Now, here's something to consider. Why can someone, we touched on this earlier, not today, last seminar. Why can someone who begins at a peak state with a prospect come across as hyper or like a typical salesperson and turn the prospect off? Remember, we began to talk about that in my response to a question. And create a response like an eye roll at an over-the-top or off-the-wall spiel that turns the listener off by the third or fourth word. The answer, they don't begin with where the prospect is. Remember, the first thing we do with a prospect is to empathically resonate, to become attuned, and find a way to communicate that experience. The result is to co-create a common ground, a reciprocal connection. Then the client or prospect together can go someplace new with you to follow your lead. You co-create a state that's a mutual journey, a process to stepwise arrive at the same place. Many years ago, when I was still practicing psychoanalysis, some of you have heard this story, I had a very succinct and powerful session about this from a very accomplished woman executive in analysis. I offered an interpretation to her that I thought was a particular insight. She paused. Finally, she rose up on one elbow, turned around on the analytic couch to look directly at me and said, "No, Kruger, first you have to be with me before I can go someplace new with you." That's a brilliant, simple synopsis of this principle. So consider these questions for your reflection. How much money, how many prospects have you lost because you haven't been in a peak state in the last 3 months, in the last 3 years? How much has it cost you emotionally, whether that's regret or pain or less energy or less money, of not being in a peak state in the last 3 months, in the last 3 years? I'm not talking about over the top hyper. I'm talking about totally present, attuned to the client. In the next 10 years, what will it cost you if you don't master this ability? In the next 10 years, what if you operate at peak state and enjoy the process? And remember, again, selling is a transference of emotion. You associate your state to the product or service. People associate your state to your product or service. People buy a state. State change is activating. So here are the mindset management principles. State is what you're selling more than a product or service. Selling is influencing the prospect's focus, the value, the benefits, the pleasure, and maybe to avoid pain. Questions determine what we focus on and the state we're in. The mindset of self-reflection fosters thoughtfulness, depth, and wisdom. So, for a peak state, match the optimum state of mind to the specific task. Anchor yourself for success. Peak performance comes from being in a peak state. The quickest way to change your state is to change the way you're using your body to cue that change. That may be relaxation, that may be a power cue or gesture to immediately put you in an optimum state. Remember, your optimum state for some things, such as a presentation, may be to energize yourself and generate optimism. For other things, like working on a client, it may be to get fully centered and grounded to be able to totally focus on that client. Or another state, to go to sleep. It may be full relaxation to go more effectively to sleep. Your gesture or your focus phrase needs to match the state you want to enter. For golfers, when I work with pro golfers, there's a different focus phrase for a drive, which needs to be big and powerful, for a mid-range shot, or for a putt that needs to be relaxed and smooth. So the focus state needs to fit exactly the task. Now again, confidence is a state of mind. We know from numerous neuroscience studies that emotions and states of mind are contagious. By an energy field transfer, amygdala to amygdala, person to person. Einstein referred to this as the unified field theory. He emphasized that we are each a bundle of energy and react with another person who's also a bundle of energy, and those energy fields intersect and interact. Same with each person and the collective energy field of a group of other people. This happens just as much by telephone. I'm here to tell you that. You do not give up or lose any of your attunement working by telephone. Confident is a state of mind. People naturally associate confidence with expertise. The induction of a shared experience, a mutual influence of energy field, can play a role in our affinity for confident people. So here's an answer to the Mindset Mastery Quiz, the Carnegie Mellon study. The major factor for professionals earning the trust of others, the confidence of the professional. Simple, confident explanations trump expertise. Mirror neurons and energy fields resonates with another's emotional state and influences behavior. Confidence is more correlated. This is important. Confidence is more correlated with success than competence or expertise. Confidence is what initially engages someone. It's what people will pay you for. Since we know that confidence is a significant predictor and determinant of success, be aware of conscious and unconscious biases. For example, in studies with business school graduates, men initiate salary increases 40% more than women do. And when both ask, women ask for 30% less. At Manchester Business School in England, Professor Marilyn Davidson said, I've been doing this for about 7 years, and every year there are massive differences between male and female responses. The male students expect to earn significantly more than the women, and when you look at what the students think they deserve to earn, again, the differences are high. We can never earn more than the outside in the outside world than we can earn in our own minds. If we earn 10% more or less than that income thermostat, we may automatically and unconsciously engage automatic behaviors and patterns to reestablish the status quo, to move the thermostat back to the set point where we're comfortable. So we have to achieve in our minds, we have to change the thermostat, we have to become comfortable with the change, at least enough to not stop it until we get to a new default setting. And again, once something unconscious becomes conscious, it's no longer unconscious. So no more excuses there. We always present in a manner consistent with our self-concept, just as we do in every other role that we play. A self-concept regulates every aspect of our lives, the software that drives the behavior. Confidence is a state of mind that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you do everything except close a sale or not make a specific professional recommendation to a client about your services and your fee, your self-confidence in that area needs to be addressed. The professional must always maintain the initiative. You've never heard other professionals like doctors or attorney say something wishy-washy like, well, do you think it would be helpful for us to work together? No, as I mentioned, the professional makes a specific, confident recommendation. You don't let the guy with the shovel decide how many elephants are in the parade. So, when's the best time to close a sale? I'll call it a sale, but a recommendation for professional services. After a vacation and you're relaxed? When you have debt? Or after a dry spell? No, no, and no. The best time to make a sale is right after a sale. Confidence is a state of mind. Sustaining an optimum state is as important as changing a negative state. And consider this from the prospect's point of view. What's the major thing that holds the prospect back from making a purchase? Fear of making a mistake? Concern of not getting value? Worry of paying too much? Question of not being able to use the product or service. The major thing that holds the salesperson back is the fear of rejection that the prospect may say no. This is important. The major thing that keeps you from getting what you want is your story about why you can't get what you want. So let's talk about, just for a moment, conversational intelligence. Neuroscientists show us the first few words of a conversation boots up a particular mindset in the listener for the remainder of the exchange. A conversation that begins with authoritative, critical, or adversarial remarks activates the brain's circuitry of fight and flight. This reaction is processed by the cortisol-adrenaline neurochemical system, so the listener may close down or get self-protective. A conversation that begins in a collaborative, collegial mode activates the brain's neurochemical system of bonding and connection and induces listening without judgment to pay full attention. This initial collaborative, trusting response is mediated by oxytocin, the neurochemical of bonding and connection that frames then the entire remainder of this, the conversation. The listener feels safe, understood. This is what we do in coaching. We engage in a collaborative model unique to all the professions that do a consultative model. Think about the same approach, the same model of collaboration in offering your products or your services. All successful sales are based on one thing. A relationship. People don't buy from people they don't like. Have you ever signed up for a weekend retreat with somebody you didn't know? And people can't sell to people who they don't like. So enthusiasm counts for more sales closing ability than any other factor. The transfer of enthusiasm changes the state of the other person. Confidence begets enthusiasm. So the key to developing an effective engagement is twofold: to know and resonate with the prospect's need, their essential challenge. That's how you get in the circle. To know your unique proposition, what you do better than anyone else. What is it that is unique and special about your product or service? In 10 words or less, Eric, and others, people won't buy your product because it's as good as everybody else's. They'll buy it because it's unique in some way for them. Your key job is to identify that unique advantage that sets you above everyone else and build your presentation around that and be able to say it in 10 words or less, because that's what we attend to and retain. If you ask a question, people are conditioned to respond to the question before they respond to anything else. Make sure your question is focused on the benefit that you bring to their issues. Now, there's some material in your outline about a mastery model that I detailed that I'm not going to go over, but I would suggest that you look at and reflect on, because it has the essential information that I wanted to convey, but wanted to talk about other things that we could develop in this way. So this is where I want to return to draw a circle. I'm asking each of you to, again, draw a circle. Inside that circle, draw a stick figure. Now, imagine that your intended client or customer is that stick figure that you want to persuade. So, to visualize this challenge, with that stick figure representing the person, this divides the world into two parts. Someone who understands the world the way that stick figure does belongs inside the circle, next to the stick figure. People who don't understand the way the stick figure does belong outside the circle. Again, that stick figure is your prospect. To communicate effectively, your first job is to get in the circle. To challenge this, if your prospects do not see you as belonging in that circle, they're not going to listen. Your point of view is not going to be seriously considered. I know I'm going over. I want to ask permission to go over about 5 minutes, I've already gone over two, if you're okay with that, because I want to develop this a little bit more. Outside, no one's going to listen to you. To enter, identify your prospect's biggest challenge. Resonate with that experience. Articulate the challenge or the main points as clearly as you can. That's why you develop a niche, because for that group and that subgroup identified specifically of people, you're going to know what their challenges are, as well as you're going to know the referral sources, the gatekeepers, to get you up to that circle so you can knock on the door. Bad metaphor. So listen carefully. Identify the kinds of emotions your prospects feel. Then put yourself in their shoes and ask why are they feeling that way. There are specific challenges. To see what they see, feel what they feel, and then find some part of their emotional experience that you can genuinely resonate with. You have to resonate with your audience where they are and find a way to communicate that understanding before they will admit you to their circle. Here's an example. It's a great description of how the circle technique works. It was described in the Wall Street Journal of how Obama began winning presidential primaries, and people were puzzled about how he was charming voters in the heartland, the very area that by all accounts, he was not supposed to appeal to. Reporter Stephen Hayes followed Obama around and analyzed his circle strategy. This is the way he put it. When he addresses a contentious issue, Mr. Obama almost always begins his answer with a respectful nod in the direction of the view he's rejecting, a line or two that suggests he understands or perhaps even sympathizes with the concern of the conservative. Remember Lincoln's approach. He moves into the circle That was Lincoln's approach to organizing a case. Hayes cited an example in which Obama was asked about the Second Amendment. He began his answer by saying that, having taught constitutional law for 10 years, he believed the Second Amendment granted freedom to individuals the right to carry guns, the conservative opinion, and that he respected the right of lawful gun owners to hunt to protect their families. Only then, after he was in the circle, did Obama go on to talk about how he thought there should be new laws to help trace firearms used in crimes. At the end of his answer, Obama employed one final circle move, kicking his opponent out. He said, "The argument I have with the NRA is that they believe any constraint or regulation whatsoever is something that they have to beat back, and I don't think that's how most lawful firearm owners think." So Obama's left standing next to the lawful firearms owners, his audience, inside the circle, while the NRA has just been declared bereft of common sense, not like us, cast out of the circle. So winning means not only getting inside, it may also mean emphasizing your uniqueness and connection. The circle vision suggests that to bring an audience to your side, your first move is to go where the audience is, connect with the audience, resonate with them, then you can move forward together. No, Kruger, first you have to be with me before we can go someplace new together. Here's a simple version of that. Most Girl Scouts are taught to memorize a fairly complicated spiel that involves introducing themselves, talking in detail about the good work Scouts do, and finishing with how the money raised goes for great purposes. This is tough for even a professional, but for a kid talking to an adult stranger can be scary. It's unlikely to lead to much positive experience, maybe a box of cookies. But here's an alternative that more than doubles the sales rate. It's the question, what's your favorite kind of Girl Scout cookie? Questions focus our brains. The first few words determine a state of mind. In 10 words or less, all the nostalgic memories of cookies past are summoned. In one simple question, not information, because information you can look to find things that you can refute that don't fit your belief. In one simple question, the power and the transaction shifts with the Girl Scout going from requesting to supplying. It's a question that avoids a no. A question starts a conversation and opens the door potentially to emotion. These are the kind of questions that create value and build careers. The experience from the buyer's point of view is an emotional connection to something that's been in his or her life since being there, since being a kid. This is a reason they don't change flavors, as well as a positive reaction to a young person learning to speak up. Selling a state of mind far outpaces only selling Thin Mint cookies. Creating and changing a strongly held belief has more to do with storytelling than with facts or logic. Storytelling is emotional, persuasive. Stories are more powerful than data because they allow us to identify emotionally with ideas and people otherwise disregarded or seen as outsiders. We tend to align with people who share our identity, even if the facts disagree. So there's a summary at the end of the outline of the Mindset Mastery principles that we talked about that I'll let you review because we are over time and I apologize for that. Any quick questions or comments before we wrap up? And thank you for indulging me with a bit more of time. There are just some things that I wanted to cover that I didn't think we would have a chance in other seminar topics. Anything just very briefly. Well, I tell you, if you have something, send it to me in an email, a question, a comment, or a clarification, and I'll address it briefly at the beginning of next seminar. So thank you very much. I hope this was helpful and stimulating. I look forward to picking up with you right here next time. And remember, we'll go over officially next time for discussion, question and answer. So thanks very much. Have a great rest of the week. Take good care of yourselves. See you guys.